How do you see the current government, current administration of Putin? We know that there is a lot of changes in the administration. And how do you see the motive behind these changes that are happening in this administration?
Well, it's really not a motive. As departing president, because Vladimir Putin is both departing and arriving president because he was reelected, it's a normal procedure to, well, not fire, to let your government, which worked with the previous term, go. After that, he begins to form a new government. I'm pretty sure that the new government will have very many familiar faces. You know, first, Mikhail Mishustin as prime minister proved to be extraordinarily effective. So is Mr. Belousov, who also posted just a few days ago a stunning, plan. And so, well, Mr. Shoigu probably stays. Mr. Lavrov, can you substitute this guy? I mean, this is like, so it depends, maybe there
Like
will be some.
impossible.
Yeah, it's like you'll be tweaking here and there, but primarily I think the core of the government should be about the same. We don't know. I don't know if Putin will let Mishustin go, but Mishustin proved to be extraordinarily good at what he does. So it depends.
This is the first time that these new regions have been voting for the presidential election and are now officially part of Russia. And do you think that some of these changes are related to those regions?
Not necessarily, but obviously you have the new geopolitical, if you wish, geographic and economic factor with obviously four regions, four new regions. Some of them are extraordinarily important in terms of the industries and how those industries will be restored. Traditionally, there have been not only granary, but also the heavy industry, metallurgical plants, things of this nature. So it certainly factors in some sense, and if effectively Donetsk and Lugansk were, well, kind of integrating with Russia even after 2015, essentially, So and it depends now what will be the new development in terms of possible new territories. So who knows?
We've learned that General Armageddon is back on mission. And do we know where he has been and what he's going to do?
We have to understand also that it's not just a single general who decides anything, because the main organ of the command and control of the Russian armed forces is actually general staff. So Suravikin was, I believe, he was in Syria, back again in Syria, then in Libya, then who knows where he was after that. And he is a kind of the tough general, as people say that he is respected. So could it be the sign of things to come? Possible, So he is definitely an offensive-minded person, but again, you have to understand, he also was the guy who said, you know what, we need to withdraw from Kherson because there's no point of holding it. So he is all around classic Russian general, extremely well educated. And obviously now with all those combat experiences from Syria to Libya to what have you, so and now with the special military operations, that might be the case that he will be put in charge of possible one of those red arrows which might appear, and strike deeper. So I won't, get ex overly excited about it. They rotate generals, and very many generals, they have their obviously own specializations. So there are many really good combat generals, really good operational strategic level generals in at the disposition at the disposal of the general staff and Ministry of Defense. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on it, but yeah, we'll see. Maybe it's the kind of indication of something which is coming significant pretty soon.
We know that he was so close to to the Wagner group? And do you think that this mission in Africa is related to his new mission?
I don't know. It's difficult to say, but we have to keep in mind Wagner doesn't exist anymore. That's what many people do not understand. There is no Wagner in existence. There is no structure. There are no contracts. In the end, there are no people who have been in the foundation of Wagner, namely Mr. Utkin. Mr. Prigozhin was merely the, money laundering machine there, in terms of whatever is left of Wagner, most of those people are incorporated into Russian Defense Ministry, and operations in Africa are now conducted under the auspices of Defense Ministry. All those people who have been in Wagner, they had to take an oath to Russia, to Defense Ministry, not to some, organized criminal group, which Wagner was, with this, which was pretty much totalitarian sect. If you all, features of it. So this is totally different. This is official Russian government, Russian Ministry of Defense operation, and those guys, they know what they're doing. Nobody says that they are not good fighters. Many of them are.
We've seen that in Russia, they're talking about non-strategic nuclear weapons and Navy getting involved, doing some exercises and getting prepared. And in your opinion, are we going to have some sort of escalations, or they're trying to show to the West that they're ready for whatever they want to do in Ukraine?
Yeah, Russia was always on record that it's ready. And actually, Russians, I'm not afraid of Article 5. It was pretty much in response to the opposition of these two chihuahuas, France and United Kingdom. Both ambassadors have been recalled to the Foreign Ministry of Russia. And especially a British ambassador was probably not only told to dial it down, but he probably was shown their list of targets outside of the Ukraine, and I'm talking about British targets, which will be hit if this thing will continue. And evidently, I didn't hear much from Britain or United Kingdom in the last few days back, except for this clown Cameron. But other than that, I mean, again, that was the in response. And obviously, tactical nuclear exercises, well, we have to understand what tactical nukes are, So any missile, tactical operational level missile, which Russia has at its disposal, is capable of carrying tactical nuclear warhead. Well, actually, some of them can carry more than that. But if you look attentively, for example, at 3M14M caliber land attack missiles, if you look attentively at Iskanders, even anti-shipping and land attack Onyx, let alone Zircon or Kinjal, they are all capable of carrying both tactical and much, how to put it politely, stronger nukes. So there's nothing new in that. Russia uses these weapons all the time. So this was merely to send the message. And I think so it basically hit the spot, now Britain and France have to think twice before they get those, bunch of their, officers or whoever puts their flight plan into their guidance systems of those Storm Shadow scalps, so about what do they want to do? And effectively, they're a laughable confirmation of that it reached, so to speak, hit the spot and reached their desired effect was that now suddenly British press says, oh yeah, Crimean Bridge, it doesn't matter anymore because Russians have the alternative railroads. I mean, these people are laughable. They are clowns, basically top bottom from MI6 to whatever the Imperial General stuff, whatever. It's just chihuahuas basically pretending that they mean something. But again, as I already stated, there was a very clear message in terms of this in 2021 when HMS Defender tried to violate Russian territorial waters, no less, around Crimea. And of course, they had their escort, proper escort, quote unquote, with all kinds of their assets of Russian Navy. But after that, Mr. Rybkov, first deputy, was quoting Mr. Putin that next time they try to do this, we're going to sink them. And guess what? Evidently, at that time they didn't get the message. Now they got the message. I don't know how many Royal Navy, what they have, 1.5 frigates capable to go to sea. So you know what? I won't be betting on survival if the actions, which are driven primarily by British, you know, it's not even pride. It's just they coping now with the fact that there are nobodies in foreign policies. But they can sink some of British ships if they continue to, you know, provide Ukraine with all those things which harm Russian civilian areas. And we're not talking about the terrorist activity, which MI6 sponsors gladly. So there you go. So
there is an article in Politico. It says that too little, too late when it comes to the aid to Ukraine. And in Wall Street Journal, another article that says by early 2025, the US and Ukraine could be on the verge of defeat. And this shows how when Wall Street Journal and Politico are talking about this, this shows how the situation is bad on their part. Hakeem Jeffries is a Democrat and on 60 Minutes, he said that we're ready to put troops on the ground. And Biden said that we are not willing to do that. How do you see the situation, the whole situation right now?
Well, first, there is no really Republican-Democrat split on this issue except for the fringes. Fringes on the left, so-called left, Democrat left, and of course what they call ultra-right, but in reality, more or less true conservatives, you know, like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz, you know, people of this caliber who obviously are more or less sane and, you know, just trying to avoid a complete destruction of what's left of the, well, not NATO, United States is in the death spiral right now. And the question is, when some lawyer, hey, nothing against lawyers, please, you know, we all need them once in a while, but Hakeem Jeffries has no clue, as nobody in his staff, or for that matter, nobody on the Capitol Hill, because most of those Pentagon generals are complete clowns. They are propagandists. They are not real generals. They do not understand what the modern war is. They don't understand what combined arms operations are or scale. So yeah, they miscalculated grossly, precisely because they're ignorant. And of course, the whole plan was actually driven by the pathological Russophobia of the neocons, namely Victoria Nuland and her hubby, and whatever the shyster organization they have, Institute for the Study of War, which, you know, supported by Mr. Keane and Petraeus, who never won anything in their lives. They lost all their wars, and they wouldn't be allowed to command a freaking regiment in the Russian armed forces because they are so incapable. So that's all was propaganda and all kinds of the interests plugged in simultaneously, from money laundering for military industrial complex to harming Russia, which was primarily State Department, and those neocons, which they hate Russian guts viscerally, and the more Russian people killed, the better for them. So it never was real strategy. United States doesn't know how to do real strategy. They know only how to compile business plans. That's about it. So, and when you look at this and you look at the means and forces which are required, so Hakeem Jeffries are free. I would suggest him to enroll, you know, into the armed forces of Ukraine, enlist with them and go to the, you know, front line and see what's going to happen. You know, some, and this is the type of people who sit in Congress and who sit and, you know, in White House administration, and they don't know anything. And they now have to kind of face the reality, which cannot be spun anymore. Well, they try, like you said, Wall Street Journal and those political, they're shysters. There are no competent people there. They're all whatever, the fake degrees, soft degrees in nothing from Ivy League. So, and there you go. You have a bunch of incompetence. Can you imagine if you would go to auto mechanic to ask him to perform open heart surgery? I cannot imagine it, but evidently, as it shows in combined West, this is the only way you can get to the, you know, to top levels of power. And we have the result. That's the result.
We had this Xi's visit to Europe, and he went to Serbia. It seems that Serbia is playing a very important role right now between the East and the West, because it has a crucial point, it seems, right now. How do you see the role of Serbia right now for Russia, for China, and what's going on between Russia, China on one side and the West on the other side, the United States?
Well, it has to be said, Serbia and Hungary being the recipient of huge Chinese investments. They are building number of the plants in Hungary. By the way, Russia also builds nuclear power stations there. And of course, Serbia is a conundrum here. They both want the so-called part of the Serbs want to, this European Union way. Others want to have their kind of traditional connections with Russia. But these two countries, that's why Z went both to Serbia and Hungary. They are absolutely crucial in terms as the bridge to Europe. But what is important, it's clear what Z was trying to accomplish in Serbia and in Hungary. But what is important was his first stop in Paris, where he humiliated Macron, basically talking to von der Leyen primarily. Well, Macron is not new for humiliation. This is pretty much his modus operandi now, to self-humiliate himself and whatever is left of traditional of the Fifth Republic, which is not there anymore, really. So, and the fact that he understands, von der Leyen is the American stooge. She works for the United States. Her task is to destroy Europe, and remove any kind of the competition for the United States. It doesn't, this plan is not working out that well as they planned it. But Z was talking primarily to her, and she was actually there as the, convoy, if you wish, placed into Yelisei Palace. And this is humiliation. You have this boy, Macron, and he's supervised by this lady who obviously is the United States asset. And Z, knowing this, he literally just kind of, pushed Macron aside and communicated primarily with her. But China obviously also in a conundrum, although it's definitely separating itself, is separating itself from dollar, which is de-dollarizing, it's still very much involved with the combined West. So and this is reality they cannot forego. And I'll give you one example where China is totally dependent on the West. Many people do not understand, but in commercial airspace, China is not even a player. People continue to talk about this, C-Comac 919, which they launched. It is a hugely troublesome aircraft. And secondly, most of it, every single critical part of this aircraft is made in European or American, subcontractors, such as, for example, LEAP engines, which are, of course, French-American engines. You have the all avionics, pretty much, Rockwell Collins, and what have you. So you look at this thing, this is just basically Western aircraft, which is being assembled in China. Granted, they do it with through the joint ventures and localization. But that's what I'm on record for years. Many people do not understand. Europe or United States are not sharing with engine technology with China. Period. No matter how they try to get it, and this is the most important part of the aircraft. China will not get access to the General Electric engines or Pratt & Whitney engines, such as the famed PW1000 series and things of this nature. But they need to, because they have to develop their own commercial airspace. And eventually, maybe they calculate, Chinese are pretty smart people, they calculate that eventually they will be sanctioned too. So after that, what are you gonna do? Russia has the production of own commercial airspace. China doesn't. And that's what many people do not understand. So he goes to Europe. And actually, France is not accidental here. France is the place where in Toulouse, most of the Airbus aircraft are assembled. And China has the, they have Airbus integration facility in one of the Chinese cities. I don't remember, but they do not have the full production cycle.
It's so amazing to see how they're trying to separate China from Russia. And they did everything. She is the one who wants Russia win the war in Ukraine more than anybody else, even more than Putin. Because it's so important for China, without getting involved in anything, just Russia is giving a lesson to the West that how this type of war can work for the West if they want to continue the same in Taiwan. And at the same time, you see the West is trying to separate China from Russia.
Yeah.
And they are so connected right now. How, in your opinion, do they really think that is that impossible to do right now at the current stage of these conflicts between the West and Russia and China? Or they still thinking that it's possible to do that?
They still think it's possible because you have to understand that China is not homogeneous nation. Both ethnically, actually, and culturally, and obviously politically. There is a certain strata, which is not a secret, who are of the Chinese people, businessmen, and political leaders who are very much connected to the West. And their bets politically and financially, obviously, have been on the West. So Xi is facing, some problems with this. And it's definitely albeit we have to admit that after the last Congress, Xi definitely has gained a lot of power. So he is pretty much very powerful, politically there. And there is obviously the simple Chinese history. So for China, it in many respects, it is also the kind of the, how to put it, not vengeance, if you wish, over combined West, which humiliated China, especially in the 19th and early 20th centuries. So it's not easy. It's possible still, but it is increasingly unlikely. So, and China understands. China is dependent dramatically on the shipping lanes of communication. If you look at the China's energy supply, especially going through the Middle East, 25% of China's energy is shipped through Indian Ocean. And so the only way for them right now to secure more or less something for possible fight around Taiwan is, of course, having the land-based lines of communication, which are being introduced and built as we speak. And of course, the Arctic route, China in this case is more vulnerable than Russia, of course. So, how to put it politely, they try. I don't think so it's going to happen. But, there is another consideration here. And this is not the one which many Chinese people who like China or, would like to accept the fact that China, in terms of the real war, doesn't have experience that much. Granted that a lot of it is based on the technology today, but still, you have to have the what I would call the general staff structure, command and control structure, which is effective and knows how to apply the, for example, technological means at your disposal in the war. So, but Russia comes here as this type of not only advisor, but supporter, and we don't know what Russia supplies China with. I'm pretty sure Russia will supply whatever China will ask, except for some very, very top of the line weapon systems. So that's probably the issue. Other than that, I don't think so they are able to separate it, even despite the fact that China still, to a large extent, it's less today, but still, to a large extent, depends on the West in some critical areas. As I already mentioned, commercial aviation being one of them.
How this connection works in Africa, in your opinion? We know that they both are active right now in Africa, and Russia is doing the military, mostly the military part, and giving some advisors to Africa. and China on the other part doing infrastructures in Africa, especially in Niger. And we've heard in Niger, in Chad, they're asking the Americans to withdraw the troops. How connected, how well connected are they in Africa?
I'm not sure about this connection because Russia obviously has her totally own interest, not related to China per se. So Sahel is very important for Russia. And do not forget, Russia was omnipresent in Arab world before the collapse of the Soviet Union. China wasn't nowhere near there. So, and when you look at actually now at the situation with Libya, for example, and Haftar, General Haftar receiving pretty much everything he needs, then Russians, going there in Sahel, in Niger, no less. There's a wonderful video of Russian and American troops having discotheque in the airways then. And it's important for Russia economically, and I don't think so it's necessarily related to China in any way. And it was traditional area or zone of interests and influence for Russia for many decades. So now if you start counting this, you have Algeria, which is huge, huge part of Russia's presence in, well, Saharan Africa, Arab world. Then you have obviously now Libya, which always was the recipient of Soviet aid. And then you have now Niger, which is, of course, also rich with the uranium and things of this nature and other rare earth minerals. And Russians are coming there not necessarily only with the military. They also, like China, can build infrastructure, which they did actually throughout, decades there. Look at the Aswan Dam in Egypt, before obviously Soviet advisors have been thrown out of Egypt, but truth is, Russia has been in Africa actually probably longer than China.
Recently, I talked with Pepe Escobar. He mentioned a very, very important and interesting point that the new relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia started by Russia. Russia started to bring them together firstly, then China came in. And this is so important. We thought that there could be something like this, but we didn't know. But Pepe said, confirmed that it was this way. And right now we are witnessing that China is bringing Hamas and Fatah together to negotiate with each other. The same thing, China that was not so active in the Middle East, but Russia, we know that Russia, how actively Russia was working in the Middle East, especially when it comes to Syria, Iran, and what's going on against these terrorist groups in the Middle East. And right now, you see China coming from background, coming to the forefront of this new type of playing in the Middle East. How do you see the new role of China in these new active movements on their part?
China comes in with an immense economy. I mean, it's the largest economy by far in the world. And I'm talking about real economy, not this BS from Wall Street indices and financialization. It dwarfs American economy, So they come with a lot of money, with a lot of resources, no doubt about it. And inevitably, this type of the economic, might translates into the political weight. So, however, I mean, you have to also remember that yes, actually, Fatah, Hamas, or Islamic Jihad, all those people have been actually invited to Moscow. It was first in Moscow when this happened, which Israel was going bananas, over it, when you suddenly have all those, separate Palestinian groups, and people who are also all kinds of the proxies suddenly sitting at the common table in Russia and producing communique that they now going to work as one. So then China comes in and we have now this situation. So it is obviously their play for their larger Middle East. But we also have to keep in mind when China went into Iran with this $400 billion package, there was actually not only some positive fees about it, there was also a little bit of consternation on the part of the Iranian business. Because obviously they say, oh, they are just buying us. Iranians are extremely proud people. So, but after that, they went out, and you saw yourself how the Iran and Russia actually got closer, much closer. And now you have this very interesting corridor, which is north-south, you know. And this is a com well, it's how to put it politely. It's not exactly in complete parallel to, for example, BRI or BRI, whatever, you know, Belt and Road Initiative for China. So it is completely different story, and it's definitely under the consideration of that eventually Europe will, you know, disintegrate into those states, which will have no obligations towards the any kind of the European Commission or United States. And they still will be producing something which will need to be moved from the port of Murmansk, you know, which is being developed in other ports on the Baltic Sea also, and go south through Russia, Azerbaijan, and Iran towards the ports on the, you know, Arabian Sea, in the Indian Ocean, essentially. So, and that is very interesting, so to speak, proposition in itself. And it is definitely not China related. They will intersect in some way, you know. And as you already mentioned in the beginning, Serbia, for example, and Hungary are viewed by China as the part of BRI, you know, Belt and Road Initiative. So it's kind of, how to put it politely, it's not competitive plans for now, but they're certainly not necessarily in coordination. Albeit a lot of what Russia and China do, they do it in coordination. For example, Xi returns to Beijing, Mr. Putin flies to Beijing immediately after that. Obviously, they're not going to be talking just, you know, about some art or whatever. They will be certainly coordinating some things. But again, let's not overplay it either. Everybody has their own interests. The matter of basically the subject of BRICS is to harmonize them, not to plug them in completely into each other, albeit at some point of time it might become a reality to a certain degree. But harmonization and being in complete agreement with everything is not are not the same thing. So we're looking in terms of BRICS right now, primarily the harmonization phase. You know, how to kind of learn to live together, kind of, you know, not to step on each other's toes, you know, in order to avoid any kind of the possible conflict situation. Because right now, BRICS becoming a major, huge geopolitical factor, which nobody even believed about it 2 years ago. And we can see it's emerging as the basically the driver of the world economy. And there is a lot to be gained from this real world economy. So we have this situation which is strategic. And plus, both Russians and Chinese, they usually think in a like long-term, you know, type thing, you know. So, and we'll see when Putin flies to Beijing, we will know the results, most of them anyway. So that will be interesting to observe.
How do you find the position of Saudi Arabia and UAE? We know how obsessed they are with their economy. Their economy is so important for them. And if these changes are happening in that region, they want to be part of these changes. They want to be part of these huge geopolitical and economic changes that are happening. And how is that going to affect the American hegemony in the Middle East?
Well, I think so. There is no American hegemony already, but it's still a very important player, obviously. So, and it's been wound down. But you have to also keep in mind that UAE, for example, has an extremely good relations with Russia. And I'm talking about those go back decades. Just I already probably gave you this example in some other interview, but if you everybody knows what S-1 Panzer air defense system is. If not for the UAE in the end of 1990s, this system wouldn't probably be, you know, around today. I mean, probably would be, but it was UAE who invested a very substantial sum of money for the system which they want to have. And Russians, you know, basically developed a system for the UAE. And UAE has quite a few of them, actually. And I can tell you one thing, they loved it so much that Russians said, hey, this is a really good stuff. Why don't we have it for ourselves too? But this is just tells you how the relations between UAE and Russia do exist. And you remember how he was, Mr. Putin was treated in UAE. It was as if he was, you know, the royal, you know, highest royal, you know, celebrity, you know, met there. Same actually with Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia, the political internal dynamics is extremely complex. There's so many, all kinds of people, including the, you know what, all those Wahhabi fanatics who wouldn't like to see anything happening there, you know? So the guy, Prince MBS, you know, he is in a pickle there. You know, it's not easy to move this thing around. So, but yes, it's important for them because they understand their economies are mono economies based, you know, primarily on the hydrocarbons, and they want to diversify them. So UAE tries to do something. They kind of assemble some kind of the even, you know, UAVs, drones, and things of this nature. But of course, they are nowhere in terms of the development and variety and diversity of economy like China or Russia. And they want the part of it. They know Iran is going to get it. And they're already getting it. They, for starters, Iran is capable to develop a lot of things on his own. So, and at here, Saudi Arabia is... how to put it politely, they're still scared of Iran. They're absolutely scared of Iran. And after the situation with Israel, guess where Arab Sea is looking at with admiration? Towards the Shiite Iran. So it's like, this is, historically, I thought it was impossible. Well, guess what? We live now in this situation. So it's very complex there. And I'm not even the specialist in Middle East, you know.
But we know how the public opinion in these countries, in Saudi Arabia and UAE, is in favor of people in Gaza. And how do they feel about what's going on in Gaza? That would be another point of difference between the United States and these countries. And when we talk about these countries, they say the leaders are in charge of everything. But at the end of the day, the public opinion matters a lot in these changes that are happening. In your opinion, that would not be one of the factors that bring these two countries even more close to China and Russia, to Iran, to these new changes in that region, instead of going with the United States, that Israel is in charge of everything that is going on right now, officially is going on in Gaza and Rafah?
Difficult to say. We know that United States definitely has a hand in Saudi Arabia. It can organize a little teeny-weeny coup d'etat. I don't know how MBS, how much he basically cleared up, you know, after the United States, but there's certainly some, you know, forces of influence there. UAE is different, obviously. But again, Iran, I mean, it's over. Egypt, for example, is a, as Scott Ritter stated, beggar country. They mean nothing anymore. They discredited themselves to the point of, I mean, yeah, so there you are. You are beggars, you know, yeah, paupers who do not want to do anything about it. Turkey, which was, you know, aiming to become a big, big, you know, leader of the Islamic world, Sunni world primarily. Well, guess what? Erdogan waited for too long. And even now, nobody believes that he actually stopped any deliveries to Israel, because most likely they continue, you know. And so the dynamics there became so complicated right now, it's difficult to even calculate. And it all came about with Iran just basically showing what a piece of garbage the Israeli and American air defenses are, you know. So, and... yeah, it's difficult to really predict anything, you know. So
we are hearing that the Biden administration is saying that they're not sending weapons to Israel anymore. And do you think that the policy is changing, or they have already sent a lot of weapons that they don't need to send anymore to Israel.
It's all PR. It's all PR. They never expected, obviously, this resonance and essentially those protests by students, especially. So it's all to placate the public because, and again, those people, they don't have policies. They are completely subverted by Israel, and Israel will tell Biden to jump, and he will ask how high. The same goes for Congress, which is completely bought by, Israelis and AIPAC and all that. That there are no people who care about United States. They do not work in the interest of the United States. They are actually destroying what's left of the republic. So in this particular case, it's all PR to, all smoke and mirrors. They already delivered more than enough, so. And yeah, it's over for this administration in a sense that we're looking at the some end of phase in the American history at this stage. After that, no matter what is happening by November, United States is not what it used to be anyway. By that time, it will be a completely different country, which I, for example, do not recognize, and many people don't do either. So it's a sad story, but it is what it is,
Andre, just to wrap up this session, we when it comes to these conflicts between Russia and China and the United States in Europe, in the Middle East, and in Asia, in Taiwan, how we don't hear anything about India. They're just gone. They're just disappeared. What has happened to India? They're supposed to have a role in this whole equation that we're having right now, but we can't hear anything about them. What's going on with India, in your opinion?
Well, India is still not their full-blown superpower. They have a lot of problems, make no mistake. So there are only three actual superpowers in the world. It is United States, China, and Russia. This is the big league. India is only approaching this, and a lot will depend on how it's going to fix actually huge problems which do exist in India economically, culturally, what have you. But yes, it's an important country, very important country. And for now, they just, work for themselves, man. They get Russian oil. how to put it politely? I mean, they're doing their thing, So in this case, there are very many elites in India, so to speak, strata who are Americanized, Westernized. They admire the West, and look at the Bollywood for crying out loud. They are all remakes of the Hollywood, pretty much. Bad, as bad as they are, they are still pretty much driven by Hollywood. But other than that, yeah. And don't forget, it is highly, diverse country. So they have a lot of those ethnic and tribal and what have you religious problems. So it will be some time before they really kind of come around and go out and say, yes, we are now claiming real status of superpower. Look at our economy. Look how we improved, people's standard of living and things of this nature. So that's what made China actually a superpower. Look what they did. They pulled out of misery, out of, just absolute economic misery, around 500 million people. This is accomplishment of the incredible, I mean, scale, And suddenly you see China, which is you go to China, obviously, my gosh, there crappy places as they are anywhere in Russia, in United States, let alone Europe. But what they did for their people is amazing. When India will do the same, and we're talking about the massive scale, not like 2-3 millions here, 2-3 millions there. No, we're talking about the lifting the population from the poverty, like China did. Then yeah, India can go out to say, you know what, we're economic superpower, we will become military superpower. Man, everybody will say, yes, you are, So that's what happened to China, really. So, and that's what it is. But for now, India just being India, they have their own interests, all right? So
Yeah.
I see.
It's seems that as much as the situation in Pakistan is unstable, and we have stability in India, that's why they're trying to replace Pakistan in the eyes of the West, in the eyes of the United States. Do you feel that?
Well, Pakistan is obviously a destabilizing factor for India. It is also directly involved with China. And China and Pakistan, they have a lot of things going between them. So in this particular case, it's kind of a balancing act. And that's what, by the way, what many people do not understand. Although being cynical, it's on the fingers. You need to write a thesis of like 400 pages just about it. But the point is, for Russia, for example, Russia knows that in the relations with China, while they are definitely allied relations and all that, but there is always India, which is the trump card for Russia, because India likes to deal with Russia too. And do not forget what Indian armed forces are. 80% of it is the Soviet or Russian, okay? So it's a very interesting dynamics, which of course really worthy of, I don't know, some how to put it, some club with their good scotch and cigar to discuss. But other than that, governments and nations, they move around having their interest in mind, and this is absolutely normal. Another matter that you know what, this so-called realism has to be just realism of the how to put it politely, real realism, realism of the harmonizing the interest and avoiding any kind of the complications. Can you avoid them? Depends on how much labor you put into it. But you know what? The question, and for the new world, which already emerged, is that diplomacy is the head of it all. Not the conflict, not bullying somebody, and it's going out and working things out. It's like Niger. They understood Russia can give them a lot. Well, guess what? They kicked the United States, which, by the way, have never provided them with anything other than dictating them what to do. So it's easy, easy diplomacy. There you go.
Yeah.